I'll begin with a little story that some of you may know, and I know at least one friend here who knows about this, which took place in London when Ezra Pound had just met the French sculptor Gaudier, Juska, and he had seen the name, the second name, the Polish name, and he couldn't pronounce it. And Gaudier was offended. But then Pound invited Gaudier to a reading. And this was a reading of a poem translated by Pound. And here is what Pound read. "Damn it all this our South stinks peace. You horse and dog papules, come, let's do music. I have no life save when the swords clash. But ha, when I see the standards gold, vert, purple, opposing, and the broad fields beneath them turn crimson, then howl I my heart nigh mad with rejoicing." Pound had imitated the Irish accent of Yeats, and when he read the first line, "All this our South stinks peace," Gaudier, who came, thought that Pound was in fact talking about urine, and he found it very interesting that peace should be piss, and he thought it was a sort of experimental poem, radical, and they became friends. Soon after, Gaudier made this wonderful phallic head of Pound, but then the war came. Gaudier, who could have avoided being drafted, went back to France and was killed 1 year later in fights. Pound, who had this friendship, decided that it was a loss for the arts and for him, and kept on mourning Gaudier, and then became what you might call a pacifist fascist, and in the name of a certain pacifism, opted for Mussolini's regime, and so on. This is just a series of reversals and ironies that have to do with the question of war and peace. Why was a modernist sculptor like Gaudier so nationalist that he wanted war? Why was Pound, who loved the idea of the condottieri, then taken up by the idea of peace? Some of these ironies are explicitly there in Kant's little essay that you have disseminated throughout these rooms in the Sloth version. In my little copy, I can only open it at the blank pages. I don't know whether Aaron has some of these. But, of course, Kant, when he begins with this title on perpetual peace, and I think you said it very well, in German is zum ewigen Frieden, which would be, in English, to eternal peace. And he begins with a joke, because it was a Dutch innkeeper who had this sign painted in front of a graveyard. So, perpetual peace is, as Kant begins, the peace of death. Okay. At the same time, for Kant, and this is the very striking argument that he makes at the beginning, he says that any notion of peace that would not be perpetual would be a lie. How does he reach this point? His idea is this: any regime who wants to have a limited peace, a peace that would not be perpetual, universal, cosmopolitan, and so on, with all the concept that Kant brings to bear on peace, would be something that he calls, by connection with the language of the casuists, like a reservatio mentis, like somebody who promises something with the intention of not holding the promise. The reservatio mentis is this invention of the Jesuits, the confessors of the 13th century, 14th century, that Pascal later on was to attack in the Provincial, by which when you promise something, you can say to yourselves, I promise to give back the money I owe you, but you can add to yourselves, when hands have teeth, for instance. And you know that this will not happen, but for God, let's say, this is the idea, you were not guilty of contradiction. And so for Kant, the point is that both a perpetual peace is the peace of death, but any peace has to be perpetual. Hence, how can one get out of this apparent conundrum contradiction? What Kant is then trying to show in this article is that a peace that is a true peace would have to be a systematic move into another domain that he calls the domain of the right or the domain of the law. And as you said very well, I think indeed in that text, Kant gives a sort of blueprint for the European idea or what followed, let's say, the First World War, the Society of Nations. But if we look at real history, we can know that the Society of the League of Nations and all the institutions that were launched in Europe after the Versailles Treaty were not particularly effective. They created many monsters, including states like Iraq, that didn't exist before, but that was one of the creations of the League of Nations and the discussion of the Versailles Treaty. For many historians of the 20th century, they do not speak of World War I and World War II, but of a unique world war lasting from 1914 to 1945, which could be truer if you see the evolution of Europe, let's say. Only perhaps with the Marshall Plan and the awareness that indeed Kant had a point, that the Versailles moment was not perpetual, but with hindsight and reservations, was the second step made possible. But Kant then deploys this logic of the rigor of the law. And it is important to see that he, as you may know, Kant was really for the French Revolution. And a number of texts written about that time were around the new, as you may know this little anecdote, the only time Kant didn't take his walk at the same time. As usual, people would check their watches and see that Kant was out. It was 4 o'clock. The only time in his life was when he heard about the French Revolution. But what he also did was a meditation on what happened to the French Revolution. And one interesting passage in the Perpetual Peace text is the moment when Kant discusses the possibility of a rebellion against a tyrant. And that, for Kant, is not possible. Why? Because his general logic is you have to respect the idea of the right and of the universality of the right. Hence, if you can admit that if a group decides that a king is a despot and would want to kill the king and replace him, that would be wrong because, as he says in a sort of twisted logic, this would be a contradiction in itself, since you could not say that there is a sort of openness in the project of creating a revolution, for instance. There would be some secrecy. That, for Kant, is bad. What he puts forward is this notion in German of Öffentlichkeit, publicity is translated in English, you could say openness. Everything has to be open, the laws have to be transparent, the decisions have to be universal. This is what is often called the formalism of Kant, the formalism of the law. This formalism is also very visible in another text that he wrote more or less at the same time, as an answer to the French philosopher Benjamin Constant. Benjamin Constant was also talking about the revolution. But he takes an example and he says, if you have a friend who is pursued by killers sent by enemies, and this friend is hiding in your house, will you tell the killers where he is? No, you will lie. And then he makes fun of a German philosopher who had said the reverse. Kant says, well, I don't remember exactly where I said that, but this is true. I believe that. I believe that if you have a friend who is pursued by killers and the killers ask you where he's hiding, you have to tell them where he hides. And then Kant has a very complicated argumentation, and he says, even if, for instance, if you want to save your friend, and you say to the killers, look, the friend is in the street. You think the friend is in a house. But the friend could have left the house to hide, and he's in the street. And then the killers kill him easily, because he's in the street. Then you are guilty. Of course, nobody can be convinced by Kant's argument. And over, let's say, two centuries, everybody who's discussed this had to conclude that Kant was really a little crazy. How could he say that? At the same time, I'd like to show that this is the same kind of logic that leads to the idea of peace. And this is an interesting setting here, where we have a sort of peace in conversation and war in noise with people coming in waves and so on, which is quite emblematic. And we always have to be, in a sense, realistic and know that people fight, kill. And Kant is realistic there. He says human nature is evil. He is not saying people are good like Rousseau would. But he says, precisely because of that, we need a state of right or the law. And the law, and this is where he has a philosophical point facing Benjamin Constant. Because Benjamin Constant is not like, let's say, a Chinese philosopher like Confucius or Mencius who would say, of course, if your son is guilty, you hide your son. You will not denounce him. Kant would say you have to denounce your son. The law is the law for everybody. But Kant says that the argument of Constant is wrong, because what Constant suggests is that you owe the truth to people who are worthy of it. So if you have killers who are looking for your friend, those people are not worthy of the truth. Okay. It sounds convincing enough. You could say good people can have the truth, but not obvious, let's say, SS looking for the resistant in the France in 1943-44. Kant says, no, you cannot withdraw the truth from anybody, whoever that person is or may have to do or may want to do. In a sense, for Kant, there is this absolute universalism of the law, and you owe the truth to everybody. Basically, if you lie to somebody, you do exactly the same thing as a state that would be ready to prepare a war by having a fake peace and, let's say, getting more powerful weapons. Or like somebody who would say that there are weapons of mass destruction hidden somewhere when he or she knows that doesn't exist, and so on. So in that general logic, Kant is unassailable, clearly. The truth is the truth, the truth is universal, but then the problem is, isn't there a divorce between truth and reality? And a Slovenian philosopher, I'm very happy that, not the same, Alenka Supančić, I don't know whether you know her, has a very interesting chapter on this debate in a book on Lacan and Kant, and she says, like all those who have studied the debate, which is a difficult, tricky debate in philosophy about the nature of truth, lies, and the political or ethical consequences of lying, that she says that for her, Kant shows that his theory is completely freewheeling and divorced from real problems of everyday life. In everyday life, we all know that we lie fairly often. According to statistics, between 5 and 6 times a day. I think, you know, this is of course a very broad average, by which we can mean little lies or big lies and so on. Like, you know, whenever we say "I love your shirt" to a friend, we want to, you know, simply be nice to, and so on. But in that sense, Kant's solution is discussed in another text, which is a funny little text, which is about the critique. He criticizes the common saying, something may be true in theory, but not applicable in practice. This is exactly the title. In that discussion, Kant, it's a political text, and his general position is that whenever one can say this about somebody or something of a principle, what is lacking is not more praxis, more practical life, but what is needed is more theory. You need more theory to understand how the theory can be applied. And in the third part of that little essay that is quite interesting, it discusses a thesis launched by Moses Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn looks at the history of humanity, the succession of wars, catastrophes, and so on, and he concludes that one cannot say that there is any progress in humanity. Humanity is always determined by a cycle of backslidings, catastrophes, and so on, revolutions. For Kant, this is not true. And this is where he adds what he thinks is lacking in Mendelssohn. And for those of you who may have read this, this is a debate that was, I think, epistolary between Walter Benjamin and Adorno about the question of, is there something like progress, or, as Benjamin believed, maybe not. But for someone like Adorno, who was a Hegelian and a Marxist, there must be something like progress. Kant would be on the side of Adorno here. And he writes this nice little sentence in which he says, well, if history is just a history of a series of catastrophes without any evolution, any conclusion, he says that, I'll quote, it may be moving and instructive to watch such a drama for a while, but the curtain must eventually descend, for in the long run, it becomes a farce. We can think of Marx talking about Louis Napoleon Bonaparte. But Kant doesn't follow the Marxian idea that history repeats itself as a farce. What he's saying is that if we see history as a series of wars and catastrophes, then it is a farce, but it is boring. It's a boring farce. I keep on quoting. Even if the actors do not tire of it, they are fools. The spectator does, for any single act will be enough for him if he can reasonably conclude from it that the never-ending play will go on the same way forever. This is Kant's, in a way, refutation of the idea that there would not be any progress. So history has to be a story, and it has to be interesting enough. If it is interesting enough, it has to be viewed from the point of view of the right, or the right of nations, or what he imagines as the society of the future, which, as we may hope, in some parts of the world, maybe in Europe, some parts of Europe, would be a society of nations in which you would have, let's say, a belief not just in the goodness of human nature. Kant is persuaded that this is what made the French Revolution collapse somehow, that because there were two Rousseauists, they would just have these factions, Girondins, Montagnards, killing off each other endlessly until a dictator arrives, Napoleon. The farce continues. For Kant, what is important is to bet on the future. The future for Kant is the possibility of never lying and of having this perpetual peace. We can only say that it is a beautiful utopia, and we should try to believe in it.
Thank you.
I think, for me, lying has more to do with memory than with imagination, because a liar is generally somebody who has a good memory. That is, that it was said of Kissinger that Kissinger would never caught as a liar when he would lie all the time, because he had such a good memory that he would remember the exact facts and the exact untrue version he would give to so-and-so. So if you have this perfect memory of all the lies you can make that are generally the inverse, you know, there are weapons or there are no weapons, you can say, there are weapons and you're lying. It's not really so much the work of the imagination. It's more the work of fantasy. Let's take a very obvious example like this. A certain administration needed to justify a certain war and then was sending people in the quest of certain things. They would eventually be found. So it's not so much the imagination as the possibility of inverting documents and then remembering what has been said or denying what. You see, Kant is saying, and this is this wonderful optimism of Kant, that you cannot do politics with a long-term result in mind if you lie. And it is, I'm not saying that it is true in everyday life, in our behaviors, and I think often lies help human relationships survive, but it is true, and this is something that I gathered from a beautiful book called When Presidents Lie, that shows how very good presidents, not only American, but Roosevelt, you know, lied systematically about Yalta to the American public, and basically the consequences were extremely negative in the end, because a lot of what was called the Cold War was a consequence of the lies about the deals between Roosevelt, Stalin, and so on in Yalta. Or if you take the French example that I know perhaps better, we know it's a little suicidal to be a Kenshin president. There was only one example in French politics, Pierre Mendès France. He lasted 6 months because he had this idea of le parler vrai, tell the truth. He would tell the truth in a situation of colonial wars and so on. Very, very hard to do. But one can imagine that perhaps with institutions taking the relay, there won't be the need to lie so much to an educated public, let's say. The second question, I think, what he says is the view of history, that is the cynical view of history, it's always the same, no need to do anything because sooner or later there will be a new war. Let's not even try to find new institutions in order to prevent them. That is the view of history he's trying to attack, which is Moses Mendelssohn, which is not absurd, he's a philosopher, but Moses Mendelssohn said, history has no meaning, men are wicked, they will kill each other once in a while, and it's like economic crises, there is an accumulation of population or gunpowder or strength, and then it erupts, and we know it's like that, da-da-da. That, for Kant, is boring. See, that, since it's a boring story, we have to reject it and believe that institutions can be effective in reaching the aim of a state of right, of international right, with transparency as a sort of model. And for the Cold War, of course, this is a complicated topic. I'm really going back to this book on When Presidents Lie. What I discovered with this, and so this is a discussion that we could have with Slavoj Žižek, because I know that Slavoj Žižek would not agree completely with that. But what seems to have been the case is that Stalin, who was relatively bloodthirsty and a dictator, would lie all the time in the politics of the party within the Soviet Union, but not in international politics for some strange reason, maybe because he didn't feel the need to lie, whereas democratic presidents in the US, because they had perhaps, and this is a limitation maybe of democracy, and it's an old, and actually Kant, you may have noted in this essay, doesn't like democracy. He talks about republicanism, which is not, of course, one should not see this in an American context. It would be absurd to say that Kant would be, you know, on the side of the Republicans and not a Democrat. But what he means is he is, like Plato, suspicious of this disease of democracy that anybody who wants to keep power will lie to the public at large, because you have to keep, you know, good pools, good results, and so on. Whereas a dictator doesn't care, you know. He can say anything at all. Why would he particularly waste his energy lying when any kind of rebellion will be anyway quelled in bloodbath? So he doesn't need to lie. That's another paradox here. But anyway, it looks like Stalin didn't, you know, after Yalta, was genuinely surprised that a number of secret clauses were simply disregarded no sooner had they been signed. And he respected his own side, apparently, of the agreement. But maybe it's a particular case. But I wanted to show you that Kant's text seems very simple and, in fact, full of paradoxes, and that he's aware himself of the ironies implied, and you might say, of the impossibilities, but nevertheless, it has to be said, it has to be argued. As a philosopher, you have to believe that there is something like a state of the nations that are at peace and have created institutions that keep that peace eternal. This is often said about the virtues of the American system, that at times they are paid for by a certain ignorance of what can be done in other systems. I think it would be good to know perhaps a little more about this. But since I live in Philadelphia, I go once in a while when I have friends or family, tourists, to the Museum of the Constitution. And that, I find, remarkable as a sort of education of the American, let's say, children, public at large, that there is a big museum teaching them about not only the texts, the Constitution and so on, but the workings of the various assemblies, the Senate and so on, and the history of it with the, you know, the racial problems in the 60s or 30s and so on, desegregation and all that. Whereas in my own country, where, you know, everybody believes that we have the best laws, the best system and so on, it's extremely difficult to have the same kind of education. There is no museum, no monument, no, you know, public space like here, where, at least in France, where you could discuss the founding texts, the founding institutions, and what democracy can mean, you know, and the evolution of democracy. For many, many centuries, as you may know, it was totally normal in a democracy to have slavery. That's a paradox. And then you had for almost a century in many countries the idea that to be a full citizen, you needed to own, say, land or a house or have some money. We have now happily moved away from that, but it is interesting to know that the very idea of democracy can accommodate systems that today we would see as totally unfair. And so think about the idea, that we can think about the idea of democracy. And I don't think it's just about punishment. No, punishment is a very complex issue, but it is part of the law. The law entails punishment. The discussions between the politicians and the philosophers should aim at creating laws that will be in the open. That is, everything has to be written. I mean, this is not far from the American idea, I believe, there, that if you have a problem, at least it should find an amendment and so on, and it should be addressed in writing to the point that anybody can at least read and discuss it, which is not the case in many, many juridical, legal, and political systems. But this is Kant's idea, that it doesn't really matter how you reach that result, but what counts is this Öffentlichkeit, you know, it's an important term for Habermas and so on, and the neoliberals in Germany. But there is this idea of sort of open text that will be, you know, it's an old question in politics for Vico when he was discussing the history of ancient Rome, the foundation of Rome, and the Roman Republic. Vico had exactly the same analysis, because what he saw was that it was the plebeians who wanted the laws to be written. And the first text we have in Latin, the 12 tables, the tables with the 12 laws, but the 12 tables were a big victory for those you might call the workers, the proletariat, who managed to have the laws at least written. They were not totally fair, since you talked about punishment. The 12 laws all ended in so-and-so will be executed. In the text, precisely, the perpetual peace text, and more than the other two I quoted, there is a long passage in which he talks about imperialism, and Kant sounds very much like Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. There's a critique of the way Europeans have brought their own laws to the New World, and they think that they discovered the country and so on. This is quite astonishing. And so Kant, I think, was, I mean, I'm not particularly a Kantian, I'm just trying to explain his position, but he would probably allow for the anthropology, and after all, he wrote a book called Anthropology at the end of his life, but he would not yield anything about universality, because for Kant, as a philosopher, it's a matter of rigor. And so you need to have a concept of the law that can be applicable to the cultures that he didn't really know much about, but he knew existed different in Asia, Africa, and so on. Because for him, the law is always the same law, and there's only one law, in the same way as the truth is only one truth, and so on. So this is a philosophical position, which is, we might say, Platonician, even though Kant is not a Platonician in many respects, but like Badiou today is a Platonician, even though he's a Maoist or communist, but he's also a Platonician in that sense that there is only one truth, and it is almost like mathematical truth. So you cannot bend it. This truth has to accommodate the anthropological moment, but it cannot be a relativistic truth. That for Kant is a contradiction in terms. The problem, I think, is how far can this relativism go if you try to erect a system of thinking that has, say, epistemology on the one hand as a model and practical life in society as another extreme. And this is what Kant, like every philosopher who is a philosopher, is trying to do. This is where, for instance, somebody like Hannah Arendt is not totally a philosopher, because she assumed that there would be a divorce between what she called the eternal truth and the facts of history. But once you have conceded that, you can have a system that would indeed could make Heidegger laugh, because it's so contradictory that you cannot hold anything. This is where philosophy here has this need of conceptual rigor that is a little terrifying, because otherwise you're caught as well. Thank you.